Pennsylvania wants its farms to be competitive, to produce turkey and pork for bigger markets. But some say there's a cost for rural communities.
The smell gets so strong, it just grabs my throat, makes it hard to breathe.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, one small town takes action to preserve its water and air quality in the face of large-scale agriculture. Plus, young people take to the streets and to lawmakers' offices to make their concerns about global warming heard.
Policy is the way to combat the climate crisis.
And we take the trolley to the neighborhood of Make Believe to learn about the environmental legacy of children's television pioneer Mr. Rogers.
You're all inside the castle, in the E room. E for emergency.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. For the first time in over a decade, Pennsylvania environmental regulators are updating their environmental justice policy. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the change will mean nearly a third of the state's population lives in places designated as environmental justice areas.
Environmental justice, or EJ, is intended to protect poor and marginalized communities that often wind up bearing the brunt of industrial development and pollution. An EJ area is defined as a census block group with a 30% or greater minority population or 20% or greater at or below the poverty level. It means permits for certain things like landfills or coal mines being built in EJ areas trigger extra scrutiny from state regulators. Patrick McDonnell heads the State Department of Environmental Protection.
It was something that we'd identified as a priority area, something we wanted to make sure we were looking at.
By revising how it tracks the demographic data, the agency says there will be a 12% increase in the number of Pennsylvanians who are considered to live in EJ areas. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
An industry that's been on a growth trend in Pennsylvania is hog farming. 2018 has been a record year for the number of hogs produced in the state. But for some communities, this isn't good news. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports on a small town where residents are trying to keep a new hog farm out.
When Alan Houck retired last year, he moved back to his grandparents' farm in the hills of Todd Township in Huntington County.
When I was a kid, we had cattle here, and chickens and pigs. We had a big garden. We raised our food for wintertime here. It's always been beautiful.
Most farms here are still small, 100, maybe 150 cows. But Houck's neighbor has built a factory-sized turkey barn that houses thousands of birds. The manure gets piled up outside.
Sometimes the smell gets so strong, it just grabs my throat and makes it hard to breathe.
The turkey barn looks like a large supermarket in the fields. It's by far the biggest structure in this small valley of rolling hills, hiking trails, and campgrounds. But not for long. Construction is starting on another large new barn. This one will house 4,800 hogs at a time. It's being built by Aaron Warner, the brother of the turkey farm owner. The hog manure will be spread on farm fields around the area. Since Alan Houck moved back last year, he's already had to replace his water well because of high bacteria and E. coli. Now he has his tap water tested every few months, so he's confident it's safe as he pours a glass at the kitchen sink.
Tastes good.
But Houck worries that the new hog farm will create more problems for his water. Many in this community of fewer than 1,000 people are concerned the manure will run off the fields or soak into the soil and contaminate their well water. And it's not unfounded.
Oh yeah, you'll definitely end up with more bacteria and higher nutrient levels.
Ryan Mather is a geologist at nearby Juniata College. He says the permeable sandstone soils in Todd Township put groundwater here at risk.
It depends on where your well sits and where the nutrients going, you know, because everything flows downhill. So if you have something that's down gradient and they're putting the stuff up gradient, it's going to get into your water.
There are currently 340 swine CAFOs in Pennsylvania. That stands for Confined Animal Feeding Operations. Russell Redding, Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Agriculture, says their waste is well regulated.
It's a very, very rigorous process.
The state has rules for how CAFOs manage manure. Plus, Redding says there are federal regulations that treat farm waste like pollution from any other industrial facility.
That's a federal requirement, whether you're in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Oklahoma.
State agriculture officials have been looking for ways to make sure Pennsylvania's farmers can be competitive, including growing the pork industry. State programs have already provided $450 million in low-interest loans to expand hog CAFOs in the past few years. Redding says animal farms are getting bigger and more concentrated in part because of demand from consumers and retailers for quality, consistency, and access.
It's one of these trends that I think everybody, even those who are in it, are challenged by to accept that that's the direction we're going because of the capital requirements, because of the intensity of these operations. But I don't believe that that makes them incompatible in the community.
Aaron Warner is on board with this new strategy. He's the farmer building the hog barn in Todd Township. He'll be raising hogs for Country View Family Farms, a Pennsylvania-based corporation that sells things like Italian sausages, barbecue ribs, and bacon across the eastern U.S. Warner did not want to be recorded for this story. In a phone call, he said his family has a right to farm their land and has been surprised by all the controversy. Many residents are worried because their livelihoods depend on Raystown Lake and the natural beauty that bring tourists to the area. Norma Alenovitz owns a campground in the township and the Chuck Wagon, where people order cheesesteaks, homemade pizza, and stromboli from the window and eat outside. It's closed on this sweltering Monday in early July, even though business has been booming.
And the hotter it gets, the more they eat. Because they don't want to cook in their kitchen.
She's worried about odors from the hog farm.
And they congregate out here and they eat out here. So I'm concerned that if there's a lot of smell, they're not going to want to be here and buy my food.
Liberty and justice for all.
Alenovitz is among about 40 residents crammed into a community hall. This night, the three township supervisors are scheduled to vote on an ordinance to ban the hog farm. Todd resident Stephanie Perez reads from the Environmental Rights Amendment to the state constitution.
The people have a right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. And we are the people, and we want to maintain what is rightfully ours.
But the state also has a right to farm law, known as Act 38 or ACRES. It limits local ordinances that attempt to regulate agriculture. Todd supervisor Matthew Barnett, who owns a small cattle farm, says the state could sue the township for passing a ban on the hog farm.
Yes, I am very concerned about that because we don't have funds to be in lawsuits.
Barnett says Todd needs its local money for road work and other projects. But when the three supervisors voted...
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Attorney Chad Nicholson of a group called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund helped Todd residents draft this ordinance. He says fights over local control are happening all over the country.
Because this is really about democracy. This is about government. This isn't just about a factory farm. We don't have a factory farm problem. We have a democracy problem in some ways.
Now comes the question. Can Todd Township enforce its ban on the hog farm? The state attorney general's office says it's considering whether to take action. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
When I say Mr. Rogers, you probably see an image of the mild-mannered children's TV host in one of his signature cardigan sweaters. But one author says there was a lot more to Fred Rogers than costume changes and hand puppets.
The guy was an incredibly creative thinker. You know, he was very edgy. There's no doubt about that.
Later on the Allegheny Front, how Mr. Rogers taught millions of little kids about big issues like immigration and recycling. Stay with us, neighbor.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like...
Young Pennsylvanians traveled to the nation's capital to take part in a march about climate change. It coincided with other rallies on Saturday organized by young people throughout the country. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk caught up with organizers before the event in Pittsburgh to learn about what they hope to accomplish.
A few years ago, when Anais Peterson was in high school, she played soccer at this field in Indiana Township.
That's the goal you always want, is down there, because it's downhill.
A mile beyond that goalpost lies a new natural gas well pad.
It's like 2 miles from two schools, a daycare, a park. It's right by this field.
Her brother plays soccer here, and her dad's the coach. She says they're now looking for another location for games. Peterson wants municipalities like this one in the Pittsburgh suburbs to beef up their zoning rules to prevent fracking in residential areas. That's in part what's driving this 20-year-old college student to spearhead the march in Pittsburgh.
Policy is the way to combat the climate crisis.
She plans to march downtown, past the offices of three elected officials. She's focused on issues like fracking and the ethane cracker plant under construction nearby. She wants climate change to be a priority in how local, state, and congressional leaders vote.
I think people feel like very empowered when they're able to say, this is like what my elected official is doing, this is what I want them to do.
Peterson is planning the march with the environmental group 350 and NextGen Pennsylvania. It's part of NextGen America, founded by the billionaire climate activist Tom Steyer.
I'm super excited. I hope the
with rain... less than 2 weeks to go till the march, Peterson meets up with NextGen's Matthew Hatfield and Becca Tasker at the group's office in Pittsburgh to finalize plans.
And we have a megaphone.
Okay.
We can bring.
It's right there.
Yes.
Oh, it's very
yes.
loud.
Perfect.
Hatfield and Tasker are both in their early 20s. They want people their age to vote to influence climate policy.
I believe that an event like we're having with the climate march is expressive of a lot of the people in the younger generation actually thinking that even though we are not at the best point now, that we can still do as much as we possibly or humanly can to fight climate change.
Hatfield says getting them motivated is key.
So we just want to make sure that we are vocal and loud about making the proper changes into the future.
Then comes mobilizing young people to turn out at the polls. NextGen plans to register voters along the route of the march. Tasker says this wasn't always an easy sell.
People hated talking about politics before 2016. It was very taboo. It was like not great. I was in college at the time, but even people my age did not want to engage.
Then Donald Trump was elected president. She says young people who think like her are waking up.
Very, very rarely do we have anyone say, oh, I don't vote. I don't care about politics.
Peterson cared long before she could vote. As a teenager, she testified in front of local governing boards on environmental issues. Now she's part of a group of University of Pittsburgh students urging the school to divest its endowment from fossil fuels. So it's no surprise that climate change affects the way she votes. She's trying to make sure it's a priority for others. Here's what she did this spring.
Before the election, I went through like all the candidates in the primary and made this giant like 15-page spreadsheet about how they felt on all the issues.
She sent it to her friends and posted it to Snapchat and Facebook pages geared toward Pitt students. Peterson wants those people to show up for the march. They'll finish at a downtown plaza where environmental groups will be waiting to talk to participants.
The young people have so much energy, so being able to connect those two and like really making this powerhouse is something I really want to be able to do here.
Amy Sisk, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Less than a week after the announcement that Justice Anthony Kennedy, the Supreme Court's so-called swing vote, would retire, President Trump quickly nominated D.C. Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh as Kennedy's replacement.
There is no one in America more qualified for this position and no one more deserving.
What could Kavanaugh's confirmation mean for the environmental cases that come before the court? The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant took on this question in the latest episode of the Trump on Earth podcast. Julie spoke with Melissa Powers, a law professor and director of the Green Energy Institute at Lewis and Clark Law School in Oregon.
Let's look forward. What are some of the cases regarding the environment that could come before the Supreme Court over the next few years?
There's been an effort by the EPA under Scott Pruitt to push against has been the ability of California to adopt its own vehicle emissions standards. So under the Clean Air Act, the basic rule is that we don't want to require car manufacturers to have to design vehicles to serve 50 different state goals. And so the general rule is that the federal government can enact vehicle emission standards, or California can enact its own vehicle emission standards, so long as it gets a waiver from EPA. And the case law regarding the waiver provision is very, very favorable to California. But under the Bush administration, the EPA said that California shouldn't be entitled to get a waiver when greenhouse gases are involved. The Obama administration reversed that position, and now the Trump administration is suggesting that it's going to try to reinvoke the Bush administration's interpretation. So the maybe slight good news is that there is a decision in which Judge Kavanaugh was in the majority, in which it said that California, generally speaking, is entitled to a waiver when it enacts vehicle emission standards. That particular case involved a challenge against EPA's granting of the waiver by the American Trucking Association. But because Judge Kavanaugh has interacted with this waiver provision before, it's possible that if there's some type of effort to push California out of the regulatory picture, that he would understand that that would be very inconsistent with the history of the Clean Air Act. So that's one case that I could see making it up to the courts. What I think is probably going to happen over the next couple of years is we're going to see just a lot of efforts, continuing efforts by the Trump administration to roll back the Obama administration's regulatory progress. And there are cases involving the Endangered Species Act that are going to be heard next term. But I haven't seen a whole lot from Judge Kavanaugh regarding the ESA, so I don't know exactly where he would come out on the legal issues that are being presented in those cases.
We've been hearing that the courts move toward a more solid conservative majority, puts Chief Justice John Roberts in a position of kind of a swing vote, a little bit of the Kennedy-type position. What is Roberts' record on environmental cases?
He's not been very swingy. He's been in the conservative side in most of the cases that I can think of. He has been in the dissent or in the majority in unfavorable cases. So I don't think that in the area of environmental regulation, we should expect that Justice Roberts is going to be the one that's going to be in the middle. I mean, I actually think that although I disagree with the way that Judge Kavanaugh has engaged in some of his statutory analysis, I think that he at least has exhibited a greater willingness to accept climate science. And he has been a judge that in several cases that don't necessarily involve statutory interpretation, but involve instead implementation of environmental laws, he has often been deferential to EPA decisions so long as there's a decent administrative record. And he has actually, in a couple of cases, struck down EPA decisions when environmental groups have challenged them. So he's ruled in favor of environmentalists in a handful of cases. And so even more than a handful, when you look at the cases involving questions of science, where the environmentalists are basically aligned with the EPA. Personally, when I looked at his decisions, there were some that I found quite troubling, but there were others where I felt like if the record is good, he is probably going to defer to agencies on scientific matters.
So he's less likely, and I'm kind of speaking a little bit out of my comfort zone here, but he's kind of more likely than, say, President Trump's other judicial nominee to the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, in terms of what they call the Chevron doctrine.
Yeah.
Like he's more likely to give deference to the agency experts.
So Chevron is a tool for trying to figure out what does a statute mean? And the doctrine basically says, okay, so the first thing that a court should do is a court should look at a statute and the court should interpret the statute to try to figure out if the statute is clear. And if the statute is clear, the court says what the statute means, and then the agency has to follow the court's interpretation. If the statute is unclear, then the idea is that the agency, as the expert, has the right to interpret the statute, and the court is supposed to defer to that interpretation. So this is all, what does the law say? What does the law mean? And in that area, Judge Kavanaugh, I think, has not been particularly deferential to environmental agencies. He has tended to look at the statute and say, I know what this statute means. I'm the one who's going to interpret it. And what I say the statute means is the right thing. That's where I think he's a little bit dangerous, because I think that sometimes his interpretations of the statutes are very narrow and they don't necessarily consider the complexity of the law as a whole. So that's the bad news part of his jurisprudence. The better part of his jurisprudence has to deal with not when the question is, what does the statute mean? But where nobody's disputing that the statute requires an agency to do something or disputing what the statute means. But instead, the statute might say, for example, that the EPA has to set air quality standards at a level that's going to protect health and welfare. And when EPA goes out and figures out, okay, so what's the allowable amount of air pollution that is going to be protective, EPA gathers a bunch of science, does a bunch of analysis, and it's in that analytical part of the agency's actions, especially where the agency is using science to support its determinations, that Judge Kavanaugh tends to seem to be quite deferential to the agency.
Melissa Powers is a law professor and director of the Green Energy Institute at Lewis and Clark Law School in Oregon. She spoke with the Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant via Skype for our Trump on Earth podcast. You can hear more of their conversation about the changing Supreme Court at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapel. Pittsburghers have a special love for Fred Rogers, the creator of the children's television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It was produced at Pittsburgh's public television station, WQED. A recent documentary about Rogers and the news of a feature film about his life starring Tom Hanks have only intensified the warm, fuzzy feelings. But Michael Long says there was more going on in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood than meets the eye. He's the author of the book Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers. The Allegheny Front's Lou Bluin spoke with Long, who says the show was a powerful social commentary that often took on the politics of the day, including environmental issues.
If you want to see just how political Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was, Michael Long says you don't have to look any further than the show's very first episodes on PBS.
Rogers was an uncompromising pacifist. And when Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood debuted nationally in 1968, Rogers used his first week of programming to share his anti-war beliefs.
At the time, the Vietnam War was headline news, and Rogers came right out of the gate with an episode depicting a paranoid King Friday arming up for a war against a force he calls the Changers. He even conscripts his own niece, Lady Aberlin, to guard his kingdom.
But Great Uncle Friday,
yeah.
I wasn't really planning to stay that long.
Yes, well, you have come during a state of emergency, Lady Aberlin, and I have drafted you. Forward, march!
By the end of the week, Aberlin has convinced Friday that peace is a better option. And this, according to Long, is the heart of what Roger's Neighborhood of Make-Believe was all about.
Ultimately, in the Neighborhood of Make-Believe, peace always wins out, and justice always wins out. That doesn't happen in the wider world. So what Rogers does through his program is invite us into an alternative polis, an alternative society. That's a political move on Rogers' part.
And Rogers used this platform to explore all kinds of political issues. Race, feminism, commercialism, and the environment.
So in 1967, there's this environmental organization called the Pennsylvania Resources Council. And they run a campaign called Don't Be a Litter Bug. So Rogers takes notice. And by the following year, he broadcasts episodes with an anti-littering message.
All right, Charlie. Neighborhood of Make-Believe.
In this group of episodes, it's Lady Elaine that plays the foil in the Neighborhood of Make-Believe, having to don a dunce cap when she refuses to stop littering. But it's in 1990, Long says, that we see Rogers at the very height of his creative power on the environment, in 5 episodes in which he explores the issue of waste and recycling.
And in 1990, there were still cities, a lot of cities, that didn't require recycling. And this didn't sit well with Rogers. So he develops this storyline in the Neighborhood of Make-Believe where there's a major crisis. And the crisis is that the neighborhood dump is overflowing with trash and stench.
They're all inside the castle, in the E room. E for emergency. They asked me to fan the smell up to the sky.
And there's a neighboring community called Northwood, and that's where the goats live. And you know, and I do, that goats are experts in getting rid of trash. This is the way Rogers thinks. It's beautiful.
Hope old goat has some good news.
I do too.
Toot toot.
Toot toot.
And the plan is that a team of highly experienced goats from Northwood will come to Make-Believe and divide all the garbage so that it can be recycled, which is beautiful. Goats, what else?
Long says this creative approach to taking on issues was vintage Rogers, but it's also important to see these political episodes in context. Watch a clip on YouTube here and there, and you might miss what's really going on in the subtext, because Rogers was most often reacting to issues of the day in subtle, usually allegorical ways. Which begs the question, if Rogers were alive today, what issues would he be taking on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
Had he continued his trajectory of concern for the Earth, I can't imagine Rogers not doing more episodes on the environment, especially given the importance of global warming. How he would do it, who knows? The guy was an incredibly creative thinker. You know, he was very edgy. There's no doubt about that.
Edgy? Mr. Rogers? It's not a word many of us who grew up watching him would use to describe the soft-spoken, cardigan-wearing TV host, but Long insists it will be part of Mr. Rogers' legacy. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
Michael Long is the author of Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers. Link to the book and feel like a kid again by watching an early broadcast of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.